Hey guys, this is Hunter Levine, and thank you for listening to the Captains Collective podcast, brought to you by Skinny Water Culture, Hell's Bay Boatworks, and Orvis Fly Fishing. In today's episode, I sit down with Adam Hudson, a local guide in my home waters of Florida's Forgotten Coast. And during our conversation, Adam shares with us some crucial tips for targeting and stalking winter redfish in shallow water, and opens up about his life and struggle for sobriety. Adam has had one of the most incredible stories that I've encountered so far, from growing up in the Middle East to traveling the world to climb rocks, ski mountains, and chase fish. Adam has lived a full life and has much to share. I'm really excited for you to get the chance to hear from him and what he has learned along his life's path. I hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.
I'll say it's anything you choose, I think it picks you. You know, it's genetic.
Let everything else stop in the world and just be quiet. And it's amazing where your mind goes at that point and where it doesn't go. And sometimes just that quiet space is what we need, and especially in this day and age.
If you have a fly rod in your hand, it's this tool that takes you to beautiful places. You meet hopefully wonderful people. And it's just this cherry on top of this outdoor adventure.
When the fish is coming, that shot within a shot, that timer start. Beep, 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 beep,
beep, beep. No one else knew anything anyway, and you're just definitely making it up as you're going along. But
so what Grandpa and Dad would tell me is like, all right, where's the old big trout laying out there? Where's his shaving cream on the water? Where's he been shaving this morning at? So look for his shaving cream on the water, and that's where he's going to be.
All right. Well, hey, Adam, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
I was like, this is my first interview in my own backyard in a long time. And I'm excited to be sitting down. We got a chance to go out on the boat the other day. Had a great time.
We had a great time. We did.
And I'm looking forward just to sharing your story. And so before we get into all that, do you mind just giving us the background of how you got into the outdoors? And you lived a pretty interesting life, so I think people would love to hear about the many travels.
Well, I've lived here in the Carabel area and been guiding here 20 years or so. But prior to that, I lived around the world quite a lot when I was younger. I was born in the United States, but both my parents are British and left the United States with me when I was only 6 months old. I grew up early years of my life in and around the Middle East. My father was a journalist covering the Middle East back in the days of newspapers. My family moved us back to England in the early 70s. Although I didn't realize it at the time, I've hated the place ever since. I'd been used to growing up in the Middle East and around the Mediterranean, and suddenly we were back in gray, foggy, cold London. I didn't like it very much. But anyhow, you know, long story short, I went to college in England, studied geology. Never really did anything with it, and took to traveling after that. I spent some time in France, New Zealand. I was a ski bum in those days and a mountain climber. Mm-hmm. Climbed some pretty wicked stuff. I was young and strong and thought I was going to live forever. skied some radical stuff, climbed some radical stuff. But I wound up coming back to the States when I was about 25. I'd always had an interest in the United States because I'd always been told that that was where I was born. Mm-hmm. And as a climbing bum and a ski bum, it was easier for me to come here and work to get by because I'd been born a United States citizen. Mm-hmm. And there was no language barrier. Which was not the case in places like France and Italy.
Yeah.
And I pretty soon knew that this is where I would stay, and I've lived here back in the United States full time now since 1985. Spent the initial years of my life here were out west as a ski bum, but I gradually got into fly fishing in the summer times out in Montana and Colorado. And I'd been a fisherman as a kid. So I kind of gravitated back into fishing in the summer, and pretty soon fishing became more important to me than the wintertime activities of skiing and such. Mm-hmm. I began to work as a guide a little bit in the last few years I lived out west. But then, as so often is the case, life changed when I met my second wife, who was from Tallahassee. Mm. And we wound up moving to this part of the world 23 years ago, because she wanted to be closer to her family, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so I made the decision to do that with her and for her. Mm-hmm. Straight away got into the salt. I was lucky enough to meet a wonderful gentleman. I hope he won't mind me using his name here. His name is Jack Butler. Mm-hmm. He was not a guide, but he was a passionate tarpon fisherman, mm-hmm. fly fisherman, and he took me under his wing, and we fished together for several years. I don't think he fishes too much anymore. He's probably getting on in years like I am. It was great to have somebody like that, because mm-hmm. I was a complete neophyte on the flats. I had no idea what I was doing. Met more and more people. Some of the real great old timers mm-hmm. that were fishing here 20 years ago, Gene Strickland, the Robinson brothers, all became good friends of mine and yeah. still are. Been here ever since.
And you had an interesting story that you shared with me on the boat of kind of you and some buddies went up north in Canada to rock climb. Is that right? The initial kind of...
Yeah, that was my first trip to the North American continent as an adult. Mm-hmm. The goal was to climb a big rock wall similar to the ones that everybody sees in Yosemite. But this is in the Northwest Territories, and it's called the Lotus Flower Tower. And it's a hard, technical, three-day big wall climb. It was, at least it was in those days. It's probably been free soloed by now, I'm sure. In those days, it was a three-day free climb. It was not an aid climb. We didn't bang things into the rock, but we used ropes for protection. But it's very, very remote, very mm-hmm. difficult to get to a float plane, and then a brutal hike mm-hmm. Up very steep terrain, carrying everything you've got to have. That was a fantastic trip. When that trip was over, the other two friends that I was with, they flew back to England to resume their lives, and I hitchhiked and took the Greyhound bus from Calgary to Denver. And
that was what interested me so much, because Harry Spear, who was the first person I ever interviewed, shared a story with me that he hitchhiked down to the Keys, where he got his start in guiding. And to me, I'm 28, so I'm thinking, he said it so casually, just hitchhiking. Is that a common thing? I mean,
It was, Hunter, and I think what we're encountering here is the disparity between your age and mine, because in my college days and my ski bum days, we hitchhiked all around Europe. Mm-hmm. People did in those days. It was safe, mm-hmm. pretty much. Myself and all my friends would hitchhike wherever we were going. Mm-hmm. I never had a problem with anybody, and I never heard of any of my friends having a problem with anybody. It was a different world.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we just have Uber.
Yes, but Uber charges you money.
And I can't imagine the bill from where you were to Denver. But talk to me about, you grew up fishing and you traveled around the world and you show up to Denver and you start guiding. What was that like
for
you?
Well, no, I didn't start guiding when I first landed in the United States in Denver. those days I was pretty much just about skiing and climbing. Like, okay. We would rock climb in the summer and ski in the wintertime every chance we could, and just take whatever jobs you could get to do it. My first job in the United States was washing dishes in the Gold Pan restaurant in Breckenridge, Colorado, which I'm informed the Gold Pan restaurant is still there. But I was the dishwasher in 1985.
Okay.
You know, we were young. We just didn't think about jobs and careers. We thought about the next powder day.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that was the first several years of living out west. Fishing was not part of it. And it really wasn't until I moved to Montana. Let's see, that would have been in the very early 90s. And started fishing there. There was a lot more water around. Mm-hmm. Lakes and rivers were everywhere. And that was really when I rediscovered fishing and began fly fishing and became obsessed with it. By then I was living with the woman who became my second wife, the lady from Tallahassee.
Mm-hmm.
We wound up moving back down to Colorado for job reasons for her. She could get a much better job there. And by then I thought I was a proficient enough fly fisherman, that I could start doing a little guiding. So I did. Started guiding through one of the outdoor stores in Estes Park, Colorado.
Mm.
That was kind of a baptism of fire, if you will. it was all good. And so then after a couple of last years in Colorado, we moved to the Tallahassee area. And I didn't jump into guiding straight away. I immediately got into, you know, fly fishing for tarpon and redfish. And I fished a lot, a lot. It was 5 years of fishing here every day of the tarpon season before I even felt remotely qualified to try to guide people.
And talk to me about that, because I think there's a lot of people who they are in a situation where they're questioning what level of proficiency and knowledge do you need to start. For you, what was your thought process like trying to come here and learn a fishery, learn a style of fishing, how to target a species? What did it take for you to get to the place where you said, okay, I'm ready to start?
Oh, that's a very hard question. And looking back on it now, I would have to say that I was not ready to start.
Mm-hmm.
But I did. You know, you're always learning. You know, I read everything I can by the great Florida guides, guys from the Keys, Homer Sasser. I listen to every interview I can get a hold of them. And, you know, those guys are still learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're always learning, and things change. You know, things have changed very much on the water here in the time I've been here. And sadly, a lot of it not for the good. There are some good things happening. You know, you're out. To me, part of being a guide, it has to be learning every day and continuing to do so. Every day is a new adventure. That's why we love it so much. You know, and learning more about the clients, getting to know them better, learning to match their capabilities with yours to find a happy medium, you know, so that everybody can enjoy themselves.
Yeah, and I think that I would assume that was a normal part of your life, moving to different cultures in different places and having to learn those cultures and to learn the way of life there. Did you find that your traveling as a child and young adult helped you make this transition into coming into this fishery and learning that? Or do you feel like
no one has ever quite put that idea into my head, but yeah. I've been a nomad, you know, for much of my life. Although I've been here now for 20 years. I've lived here in Caribel longer than I've lived anywhere else in the world. People who know a little about my earlier life and all the traveling around will sometimes say to me, well, how on earth did you wind up in Caribel? And my answer to that is, well, if I ever figure it out, I'll tell you.
Well, that was my, you know, when I first met you, that was my first question that I had in my mind. Well, because we were at the ramp and you started talking and I'm thinking, how did this guy with a British accent end up in Caribel?
Trust me, there's a lot worse places you could wind up.
But yeah, I could definitely see that, and seeing that be some sort of advantage. And for you, you know, you got into rock climbing, and you got into skiing, and then you got into fishing, then you got into fishing in a new fishery, and you've had a lot of kind of rebirths or, you know, kind of restarts on things. And something that you also shared with me was you got to a point in your life where you were drinking heavy and you kind of came through a new rebirth of getting to the other side of that and entering sobriety. Could you share with us too kind of that journey for you? And
I'll be happy to share some of that with you. Drinking heavy doesn't even come close to describe what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I came very, very close to completely destroying my life with alcohol. And I'm a recovering alcoholic. I just celebrated 7 years sobriety.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And it's hard for me sometimes to talk about this without getting a little emotional. I had gotten to a point where I was, although it seemed like, I think, for somebody looking at the outside of my life, it would have seemed like everything was great, but for whatever reason, I wasn't happy with myself. And, you know, happy people don't become addicts. It's unhappy people who become addicts. But, you know, I went from being somebody who had always drank a fair amount and socially to suddenly becoming somebody who was severely addicted to alcohol. And it cost me my marriage. It cost a lot of things. I'm very, very grateful that one thing it didn't cost me was a car wreck in which I hurt someone else killed myself or hurt someone else. That could very easily have happened by some miracle. I was spared that. But I think, look back and think of what I could have done. So anyhow, you know, long story short, you know, I tried rehab a couple of times and that didn't work. What did work for me in the end, what helped me to get sober, was that wonderful organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. I still attend meetings from time to time, and a lot of my friends these days are people that I've met through there. And I have to be very careful not mentioning names because, you know, it is Alcoholics Anonymous. And and for many of the people in those meetings, people I know very well, anonymity is important for them to be able to maintain sobriety. It's not for me. In fact, I'm quite the reverse. I hope that by being open about it, if that means that one other person who was suffering the way I was suffering can see me now, and I can perhaps give them a little hope, and then it perhaps would have been worth it. One thing that I would like to say about all that is, you know, after I'd started down the path to sobriety and, you know, maintain sobriety for a little while. And I'd, you know, I'd messed up. My guiding was shot to pieces. I'd let a lot of people down. But when I started trying to come back, the response from friends, other guides, other fishermen welcomed me back with unfeigned joy to see me sober and happy again. You know, these people were truly glad. It was really wonderful. And I think about that all the time. And you mentioned, you know, having been all over the world and wound up living in little Caribel here. Well, Caribel too was there for me when I started, you know, confronting my issues and trying to get sober. It's a small community and, mm-hmm. you know, people knew I was a drunk. And everybody in this little community here was happy for me. And that helped me to stay sober, knowing that people cared that much, mm-hmm. you know.
I haven't done any skiing or rock climbing outside of, you know, maybe going to a rock gym or something. Any real, what I would assume to be real rock climbing. But I've noticed that there's a correlation a lot of times between like the ski bums and fly fishing and just kind of these different types of things that seem from the outside very different. You know, skiing down a mountain, fly fishing on a skiff. But one of the things that, to me, from my vantage point, seems similar is that community piece. It's a bunch of people who are very obsessive about these things that most people think are hobbies. Yes. Hobbies, not really the right word. And they're really tight-knit communities. But I think there's also a lot of people who are involved in it that don't really know how to maybe be involved in that community in a meaningful way. For you, you're saying you kind of leaned into that community. What does it look like to lean into a outdoor community in a way that's beneficial, and how did that play out in your life?
It's a feeling you get. Of being on the cutting edge and of being around people that understand what it is that you're doing and what drives you. Mm-hmm. You know, most people don't. You know, most people ski a little bit, 2-week vacation once a year, or that they go fish, but they have quote unquote real lives with families and real jobs and that kind of thing. And they don't understand. Well, they don't just, no, it's not they don't understand, it's they don't have that same feeling where they're willing to sacrifice a comfortable, secure life to go pursue these dreams. There's a great quote in the history of Ernest Shackleton, who was one of the early Antarctic explorers. On their way down to Antarctica, they stop at a whaling station run by Norwegian whalers in the, you know, this is in the early 1900s, and one of the explorers says to this whaler, you know, why do you come down here to the bottom of the world and live like this? And the reply was, because we're no damn use anywhere else. You know, that's people who, you know, make the first ascents of great mountains or can devote themselves to fishing for fly fishing records, and the time and devotion and skill that takes, you know, for the most part, they're not going to fit in with what our culture has come to expect of us, which is not much. I don't know if that answers your original question, but
no, I think it's all definitely in the right direction of kind of for you, you know, you're trying to pursue sobriety and trying to rebuild your life in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And, you know, and I had lost my drive to the drive that took me to those mountain peaks or down those extreme ski slopes or, you know, to the push pole of a tarpon skiff day after day. I had lost that drive. And one of the most fantastic things about getting sober was to find that it was still there waiting for me. It was just waiting for Adam to come back, you know. I'm almost 60 years old now, but I still feel that drive inside me just as much as, you know, these days it's to get out in the skiff and do the best I can for a client, or if I'm fishing with a friend such as yourself, to make it the most successful day we can. That's the same drive that took me up those mountains and down those extreme ski slopes. I'm older and slower and not as physically strong as I used to be, but mentally that drive is still there. It really is.
Yeah, I think that's a great connection point too, to all these other outdoor communities that are very different in a lot of ways, but are filled with people who have this insatiable drive learn and get deeper and deeper and deeper. Did you feel coming on the other side of that, where you had your drive back, that you needed to guard it or protect it, or did it just kind of flow back natural?
It just flew back natural. It felt like coming alive again, actually. It's great to feel that every day. I look forward to waking up every day to see what's going to happen. I'm so lucky to be somebody that can wake up every day and not quite know what's going to happen. Last week it was taking a tricky, but I hoped okay shot at a deer from a tree stand. First deer I've killed with a bow in probably 5 years. The animal did not suffer. It was a clean, quick, clean kill. I was very, very caught up in the hunt. It was a great experience. Thanks to a good friend of mine who invited me to hunt a very nice property that he owns out of state. It was wonderful.
I think that for a lot of people who maybe are in a place where they're either rock bottom in addiction, or maybe they've just gone numb to something that they used to love, I think that gives people a lot of hope that maybe they can reconnect with that former drive.
I hope so. People, we're back to talking about addiction again. There are so many different kinds. People sometimes ask me to talk to another family member, who's having a problem, and I do my best, but it does have to come from within in the end. For me, I knew I'd lost my drive. I'd lost the things that made me who I was. And it was such a relief to find those things were still there inside me, that I don't ever want to do anything to jeopardize that again. I'm very lucky. I have a great set of friends and continue to meet new ones such as yourself. Have a good home. Live here with my dogs and my cats. So many people that have problems with drugs or alcohol lose out all of that, lose everything, and then it's so much harder for them to come back. I had all this waiting for me. I didn't lose. I didn't go to jail. I didn't lose a whole, all my money or that kind of thing. Some people lose it all and wind up on the street.
Well, I appreciate you having the courage, I think, to talk about it. And really, I think that's one of the things that I fell in love with doing this podcast, of going around. It's a form of journalism, much like your father, and to get real stories. And I think in a lot of places in the outdoor world, there's these picture-perfect photos of guys wearing all the right clothes with all the right gear, all the right places, and seem like they're so put together. And you're looking at all these images of people that look like that, and we all have these inner demons, and you wonder, well, that guy is a million miles away from me. But you realize that, like, that's a photo. That's not that photo can't capture a full life. And so, not that podcasting can, but one of the things I love about podcasting as a medium is it can capture a lot more. And so I appreciate you for sharing that part of the story. I do want to talk about fishing, though.
Let's talk about fishing.
I do want to talk about fishing, and I want to talk about, here we are. It's very cold today. I had frost on my push pole today, and for us panhandle people, anything under 40 is very cold to us. But in the winter, a lot of people, even in the booming metropolis of Carrabelle, Florida, just don't fish as much. It's just not as much tourism, if you want to say tourism. But, you know, there's not as many people coming around, but yet there's incredible fishing. And
there is, and it's, you know, this is one reason it's become about my favorite time of year to fish, because there's nobody out there. There's nobody at the boat ramps. You know, there aren't party boats and jet skis and things running around, all the things we've had to learn to live with in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
Fishing can, it's been a great fall, but this is, as you just mentioned, the first severe cold front of the year, so it's going to slow things down a little bit, but, you know, I love, really this time of year, I pretty much just target redfish in the shallowest water I can find them in.
Mm-hmm.
And that, until the water really gets too cold, that often entails wade fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people do that here. And it really is, my favorite thing to do with redfish is to, you know, anchor up on, you know, the any of the sandbars, you know, surrounded by grass flats that we have so many here. The water's typically very clear this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get out and wade these fish in, you know, water that's less than your knees. And they're not the big bull reds that everybody wants to get excited about, but they're tailing or just cruising over the sand in very, very shallow water. And, you know, good-sized slot fish. A 7 or an 8 weight fly rod is perfect for them. Mm-hmm. And you really have to stalk them. They can be spooky.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging. You know, it's challenging stalk. It's, you know, reminds me a lot of fishing for bonefish, and it's just a blast. I love being out, you know, wade fishing and taking the boat out of the equation. Now you're more in the fish's element. There's just less mechanical things between you and the fish. Just you and a fly rod.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little box full of flies and a bottle of water stuck in your back pocket, and you're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
I would, if anybody's going to try it, I would advise having some kind of flats wading boots on, because there are things there that will stick your feet or cut your feet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a blast, and then just, you know, poling the skiff for the fish. Again, a lot like bonefish. The reds are not particularly picky about fly, but they'll spook from a badly presented fly line.
Mm-hmm.
Longer leaders become necessary as the water gets shallower and clearer. Mm-hmm. It can be technical, which is, of course, why we do it.
Yeah, give me a few technical tips on wading for redfish.
Okay. I would advise just a 7 or 8 weight fly rod. 10 to 12 foot leader that tapers down to about 10, 12 pound fluorocarbon. Pretty small flies, shrimpy, crabby imitations. You generally want, you know, a darker imitation if you're fishing them over the grass and a lighter one over the sand. You want to lead the fish 1 to 2 feet, really. If they're tailing, it becomes different. You really need to wait till the tail goes up in the air, which means his nose is right down, and then it's got to be, you know, aim between his eyeballs, mm-hmm. and he might see it.
You know? I just experienced that in the flood tide.
What we're also seeing more and more of in this area the last few years is black drum.
Mm-hmm.
As we refer to them over in Louisiana, marsh donkeys. The big ones, you know, you have to cast at them a lot to get an eat out of them over here. And they really don't fight all that well. But they're fun to cast to. But the little ones you'll see cruising over the shallow sand flats just the same way that the redfish do. And they can, they're fun. They'll put up a pretty decent fight. They can be picky as well. Mm-hmm. And those little black drum are really good to eat.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that. I haven't cooked one.
Yeah, they are.
What's the key there? Any tips on dealing with them on the grill or oven or what?
Just any way you want. Just treat them like a redfish. Mm-hmm. I almost never deliberately kill a redfish. I try to release them all. You know, I basically feel that a redfish is just worth more to me swimming around out there than he is on someone's grill. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, I don't feel the same way about little black drums. So,
well, we see a lot more than we can catch.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The other day we were out there and it was like, black drum, try. Nope, black drum, try.
Yeah.
So when you do get one, you don't feel like there's
exactly
the issue. Yeah. You don't feel the same. So when you're looking for, you know, I guess one of the things that comes to mind when I'm thinking about wade fishing is you're much more married to the spot that you're in, at least at first, because, you know, on a boat push pulling, you can pull fast. You can, I feel like, cover more ground.
Well, it's interesting you say that. You know, wade fishing, yeah, you can't cover the ground that you would in a boat, obviously. But you're going to cover some ground. I mean, I've wound up almost a mile from my anchored skiff all by myself and then had to turn around and walk back with the sun setting right
and
in
hopefully the right tide.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. The biggest piece of advice I would say to when you're waiting is to really slow your pace down. Don't worry about covering a lot of ground. The slower you go, the more you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell myself to start. I'll get out there, you know, to go wade fish one of my favorite places all by myself, and I'll be all wound up. And you know, after, you know, 50 yards from the boat, I'll have to tell myself, Adam, slow down. And then you start seeing things. Because it's not always easy to see the fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like stalking anything. You're not, oftentimes you don't see a whole fish. You see part of a fish or a shadow. And you've got to slow down to see those things and recognize them for what they are, which is your target. So, you know, really slow the pace down. Just moving slowly, watching everything. And after a while, you'll just, I hope, be enjoying as much as anything just walking so slowly and observing the life, the other life that's going on all around the flats. You see some really cool stuff, little things, the little life of the flat that's just going about its normal routine, oblivious to you. You know, you can learn from observing that. You can learn about what drives, you know, what things that affect fish, but it's also cool just to see the other flats life, because there's so much of it. And we get so focused on the fish, but there's so much more going on down there, you know.
And even when we were fishing together, you were looking for, you know, we'd go up to a flat or something and you say, there's no life here, let's go.
Yeah.
What are other things that you're looking for when you're trying to scout or find a place that you're going to commit that time to and slow down? Are there certain things you're trying to key in on, or is it just really a little bit of a roll of a dice there?
It doesn't take long looking at a flat, whether it's from the polling platform or from standing in the water. It doesn't take long for me to get that feeling that either, yeah, this is good, or no, we need to go look somewhere else. And it's part of it is, you know, seeing things like sharks and rays. But the other part is just a gut feeling, I guess, that, or perhaps, you know, seeing things that you don't really know you're seeing, just, you know, overall life of the flat. I'm going to have to think about that one. Yeah.
Well, you did something I've never seen somebody have the skill level of, hooking a black-tipped shark on the dorsal fin. Because we thought that that fish was fighting very hard.
I thought that fish was fighting very strangely, yeah. Poor thing.
Jeez, Adam really knows how to set the hook on that dorsal fin.
Trust me, I was as surprised as you were.
So... You know, I would love to kind of transition to some rapid fire questions.
Sure.
I think that was all just great insight on some winter fishing, and we'll circle back to some of that. One thing, a rapid fire question, I guess I had lined up in my mind is, you know, when you're going from being a mountain climbing ski bum to trout fishing freshwater to coming down here to the Panhandle and seeing these redfish and tarpon, do you remember the first time that you ever hooked up with a redfish?
I do. It was over there in Alligator Harbor. I didn't even have a boat at that point. I had a kayak. And I would just paddle out to anywhere I could wade fish. And I was wade fishing over some grass flats right there, just off of Highway 98. I knew there were fish around. I'd waded right over a couple of reds and spooked them. And there were plenty of mullet around, and somebody had told me that was a good sign. I think this must have, you know, this is probably my first summer down here. I was just methodically blind casting, and caught a couple of redfish right there. And I jumped the first tarpon I ever threw at as well. Like everyone, yeah. That was that was with Jack Butler, the friend I mentioned earlier, out on his skiff at one of the popular tarpon locations that we have here.
Well, I think you just described all of them.
Yes, the all too popular. it was really early, must have been really early in the season, because there was nobody else there. But, you know, this was, you know, 22 or 23 years ago when nobody started fishing for tarpon here in April. You know, tarpon, you didn't even think about it. Really till May or June. And that was, I mean, on the one hand, that makes me think, you know, that was such a long time ago. But on the other hand, it also makes me think, wow, how things have changed in a short time, in just 20 years, you know. Because those tarpon were always swimming there at that time of year. It's just nobody thought it was worth looking for them. But anyhow, we'd been fishing for reds and other things during the day, and Jack just, later on he told me conditions just looked right, so he thought we would just go and set up on that spot and just see if anything happened, and sure enough, a single fish came by, and I put the fly there, and he ate. He didn't have him on very long.
Tell me, so, you know, we've kind of made a connection that, you know, you've been in a situation a time or two where you had to learn a new context, a new fishery, a new culture. Tell me about that relationship with Jack. How do you feel like if you're a young angler or you're young in a certain species, I should really more so new to a species or type of fishery, what do you do to try to maximize that, get the most out of that relationship?
You know, every relationship like that is going to be different. And it's a relationship that often shows up in, you know, angling literature, you know, the old, mm-hmm. the old man and the boy.
I've read those. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I don't have any children. I get a lot about, I really enjoy taking younger, people out there fishing and watching them, you know, turn into a good angler.
Mm-hmm.
It's really rewarding to see that happen. A young friend of mine, I'd say a young friend, he's in his late 20s now and about to get married for the first time, a very good friend of mine. I first met him out on the water. He was sitting in his uncle's skiff. He was 12 years old, and he looked so lost and out of his comfort zone. You know, this poor 12-year-old kid just sitting there in this boat with no idea what was going on, and he's now a very, very good tarpon angler,
mm-hmm.
and redfish angler. You know, he's a flats guy. He's got lives in another part of Florida, but he has his own skiff and
mm-hmm.
Poles it. And it's great, you know, just to see that happen. You know, the downside of it, of course, is it makes you feel kind of old. You know?
I haven't got that yet.
Yeah, you will. Trust me, you will.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, you better hope so.
So, you know, we're sitting here right now at your fly tying table. You have one of the coolest fly tying corners. You don't have a room. You have a renovated, really cool, you were telling me about these beams around us, really cool man cave of sorts. And I noticed, you know, there's a lot of literature around.
Yeah.
To you, what are some influential books in life and fishing that you'd love to share?
Oh, at the moment I'm rereading for the umpteenth time Tom McGuane's book. It's an anthology of his fishing stories called The Longest Silence. It's one of the best fishing anthologies I've ever read. Thomas McGuane to me is such an awesome writer. He can describe, you know, losing a great fish or landing a great fish, and in such clear, concise words, leave you feeling just as much as he felt at that moment. His style is so clean. I've tried to write myself over the years, and it's never really worked for me, at least to my, you know, to my satisfaction. So I'm in awe of somebody that can write like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another great one is John Gearock, who doesn't really, I don't think he's written anything about saltwater fly fishing, but he can really bring the world of the fly fishing junkie to life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he can do that. How to books, any of Lefty Cray's books, mm-hmm. are well worth reading. I was lucky enough to meet Lefty Cray, I think it was only 2 years before he passed away. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd had the chance to meet him earlier, but I just was lucky enough to be able to talk to him for a few minutes at a fishing show, and he was such a gentleman, such a humble man. You knew that immediately just mm-hmm. talking to him. He was just a wonderful guy. For tarpon fishing, Andy Mills' book, there's a lot of very great information in that, and it's also a pleasure just to read and look at. The photography in that book's awesome.
Yeah. I think that's that was one of the first tarpon books I read. I thought it was really good.
There are others that are.
Yeah. Have you read Bill Bishop's?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought Bill Bishop's was a well done book. But yeah, I think Andy's ties together a lot of great visual with information.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of great, I think, literature that's been collected over the years on.
Fly fishing has a wonderful tradition of literature. And I have some books in my possession that I really treasure. Two of which are Roderick Haig Brown's books. He was an Englishman who emigrated to Canada after the war and really wrote about steelhead. And I've never fished for steelhead. Mm-hmm. I would love to one day. But his books, again, they're more than just about fishing. Mm-hmm. They're wonderful. They really evoke, you know, what it must have been like to be living on the west coast of Canada in the late 1940s, mm-hmm. when it was all, so much of it must have still been pristine. Mm-hmm. You know, these great runs of steelhead and in the rivers that just don't exist anymore from what I understand.
Well, you talked about the legacy of literature and fishing, and I think, you know, that's something I have a lot of fun. I'm a creative writing major, so a lot of my degree was based in literature, though. You have to read a lot before they care about you writing. It's kind of like journalism.
Yeah.
We joke journalism with crayons and poems. But I'm a little fearful, like many people, that attention spans are shrinking and all the pictures and photography and videography is incredible, that there seems to be less and less and less desire for people to see written literature. What's the case? Well, if you had to give the case for the median of writing, what are you going to say?
You say that, but there are still, great magazines that feature great fly fishing writing. Mm-hmm. Drake, and Fly Fish Journal, Tail Magazine, and these are all relatively new. These have, you know, come along, and to some extent, you know, replaced some of the older saltwater fly fishing magazines that aren't around anymore. That really featured, you know, all they really featured was how to and where to.
Mm-hmm.
And these newer magazines that have come along, a lot of what they feature is what we can certainly call creative writing,
mm-hmm.
Literature, prose.
Yeah.
People still want that.
The packaging has changed. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. Same with blogs. So my next question is kind of tied to some of what we had talked about, I guess, a little bit earlier, but in what ways do you feel like traveling has shaped you as a guide? Because you've done a good bit of traveling, like long-term traveling too, I guess.
Well, on the one hand, you know, traveling so far around the world, has maybe more open to, you know, people of different backgrounds. I've had the privilege and pleasure in the last few years of fishing a number of clients who came here from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And I love encountering people from overseas and learning about their fishing worlds back home. But on the other hand, you know, becoming a guide here in Caribel was really what finally caused me to say to myself, for the first time in my life, okay, here I stay. I'm staying here. I love it here, you know. It's a great part of Florida. It's a great part of the world.
Yeah.
It's so different from other parts of Florida. You know, I spent all of last winter and the first part of this summer in the Keys, which is the first time I've ever spent any protracted time in the Keys, which was wonderful. It also happened to be when the COVID virus reared its ugly head and everything went into lockdown. So I had the added benefit of learning my way around the middle and lower Keys with nobody else there, which was great. And I fear may have forever ruined the Keys for me because it will never be that way again. But I wanted to come back here. The Keys is a fantastic place, and I see how recognized how different their fishery is, how much more technical it is. And fly fishing has a much longer and deeper rooted tradition in the Keys, which it, you know, doesn't really have here. Although more and more fly fishers are coming here, or there seem to be more and more people who live locally who are who are either already fly fishers when they move here, or getting into it, which is great. But yeah, you know, being here in this community, being part of the guiding community here, it was the first time in my life I felt I'd found somewhere where I wanted to stay. So here I am.
So your father was a journalist.
He was.
In what way do you think that shaped you as a guide and angler?
It made me never want to have anything to do with journalism. I don't know, Hunter. I'm not sure I can draw any correlation there.
Yeah. That was a Hail Mary for me.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was driven to be the best journalist he could be, perhaps in the same way that I've been driven my life to do very, very different things. But he had drive and pride in his work. He was old school journalism when newspapers were it, and you know, he belonged to that old school of journalists that really felt journalism had a responsibility and a duty to present things in a balanced way, tell both sides of a story. He's probably spinning in his grave about what's happened to journalism these days.
Yeah, it's very politicized and weaponized and sensationalized and all the isings.
It's a very, very different world.
Yeah. So my last question is one of my favorite questions to ask people, which is, if you were sitting down today with that kid who had just decided he was going to hitchhike and greyhound his way down to Denver, what are you going to tell him?
Don't worry. It's all going to be okay. Yeah, I was scary, nervous, doing that all by myself on a continent I didn't know. But it all worked out okay. There's been some ups and downs along the way, of course, but everybody gets that. I hope I got a few years left in me yet, so I hope maybe we can be having this conversation in another 15 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for hosting me tonight.
Hunter, thank you for coming. It's been great sharing a little bit with you, and I look forward to our next trip out in the boat.
Thanks again for listening to the Captain's Collective. Please help us out by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast. We hope that you enjoy. This is the Captain's Collective.